Hey guys, it is Ryan. For years, Chumba's been setting the bar for online social casino fun, and it just keeps getting better with new games released every week and daily bonuses to collect. The fun never stops. So claim your welcome bonus now at chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 21 plus.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick's Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick's Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.
Hello and welcome to Brokenomics. Now, in this episode, I'm absolutely delighted to be joined by Harrison Pitt. Harrison, thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Dan.
Now, you're a clever young chap, and you went to Durham, didn't you? And then you went to Cambridge.
Yep.
So you've got an excellent CV behind you. With that, you could have sort of written your ticket to go anywhere, and yet you kind of went straight into right wing circles, and then gravitated to reform.
Restore.
Before it even sort of had any traction. It was basically just one MP.
Yep.
Given that you could have gone anywhere, what attracted you to Restore?
Well, I'm not sure I could have quite have gone anywhere because I suppose I could have pursued life as a lawyer if I'd wanted to do that. You know, maybe done something similar to what Sumption did. When he, because he got a bit bored of the academy because he didn't feel like he was making enough money, and so that's why he went into the law in his 30s, having written lots of sort of academic historical works about medieval French history and all the rest of it in his 20s at Magdalen. But I wanted to pursue a life in the academy, which actually is not that well remunerative unless you live in the United States. Here, it pays a pittance. But that is my passion. I'm interested in philosophy. I'm interested in intellectual history. I'm interested in a field of philosophy called metaethics, and I would have liked to have pursued that at within the academy, and I was sort of on course to do that. I did a kind of philosophy and history degree at Cambridge and MPhil at Cambridge, but it became, which I suppose must have finished in around 2022, 2023, but it became clearer and clearer to me. I already had, you know, I was already fairly well ensconced within what we might call the transatlantic right-wing sphere, given my connections to two people in particular, Ellen Fantini and Mario Fantini, who are very well connected American expats living in Europe, who run the European Conservative magazine. They wanted me as a senior editor. And it just became clearer and clearer to me that my skills, such as they are, were more needed in this public struggle than...
But in the political... So you made the decision you wanted to go into the political sphere. But nevertheless, still, at that point, Conservatives would have taken you, Reform would have taken you.
Oh, I see, right.
But you jumped straight over those.
Oh, right.
And you said, I'm going to go to the thing with one MP and sort of no real electoral track record behind it because that one MP was elected as a Reform MP.
Yes.
Why did you do that?
Well, because I think much more highly of Rupert Lowe than I do of any of the otherwise mentioned.
For what reasons?
Well, if you want some of the backstory on that, which maybe you do, I was already in the commentary space, I suppose, in that I was speaking at I still am a fellow at the New Culture Forum Institute in London. So I was doing regular sort of political commentary programs with Connor Tomlinson called Deprogram, which has since been discontinued. And I was, you know, writing regular essays for the European Conservative Journal, which is a kind of quarterly academic, semi-academic journal, was led by Mario and Ellen Fantini. But it became clearer and clearer to me that Reform in around, I suppose, we're talking about the years 2023 to 2024, were kind of veering away from what many people thought they were, namely a movement to prioritize the interests of the host population of Britain over the interests of imported subcultures.
I mean, I very much remember watching that track myself and thinking, yes. Oh dear, this is a bit worrying.
Yes,
but at least they've got one good MP. I like that Rupert.
Yeah, that was one of the reasons why I hadn't fully thrown my toys out of the pram yet when they still had Rupert Lowe in the party. But although I was very concerned about it, and what actually happened, and this is now in the public domain, in December of 2024, Peter Whittle, the late Peter Whittle, the director of the New Culture Forum, used to host these little monthly seminars within Tufton Street inside London, in which he would gather sort of the great and the good of kind of public-facing right-wing think tank world and politicians and all the rest of it to have monthly discussions on the state of the nation. What are we going to do about it? Is the Conservative Party the vehicle? Is Reform the vehicle? And every month, different guests would be invited. So Matt Goodwin addressed one of them, and I was quite critical even then. Okay. James Orr addressed one of them. David Starkey addressed one of them. Ben Habib addressed one of them. Alp Mehmet addressed one of them. And eventually, in December 2024, I think it must have been, Rupert Lowe. It was Rupert Lowe's turn to address us. And I was there. Connor Tomlinson was there, Charlie Downs was there, and some other assorted right-wing reprobates were there too. And I similarly was very fond of Rupert Lowe even then, and I saw him as one of the best remaining things about Reform, such as it was in December 2024. I keep saying 25, I mean 24. But I was also fairly critical of the way in which Reform were drifting. I was very critical of Farage. I was even somewhat critical in a gentlemanly way of some of the things that Lowe himself had said. And I was struck by the fact that whereas Farage doesn't take at all well to criticism, Lowe actually thrived off it and does so even now. He and I have calls fairly regularly and we don't always see eye to eye. And he's actually interested and he's actually curious because he wants to get things done right. And it became clear to me that he really was a serious person, not just because of the edits that were online, but because of the interpersonal interaction that I had had with him during that hour and a half, and then we went to the pub afterwards and all the rest of it. And then it was in February that he was chucked out of the party on trumped up charges of bullying. Farage has now admitted that it had more to do with politics and had more to do with egos. That's Farage admitting that, not Lowe admitting that.
Specifically, it was because Rupert was saying that we need to support the grooming gangs communities.
Yep.
And Nigel later admitted on stage that this was a thing that was completely unacceptable. We must, of course, keep the grooming gang communities. We can't support them.
Yes.
And that's why they made up charges against
them. That's exactly right. But if I had to put it in a nutshell why I saw... By the way, I think that's part of the reason why I was brought on when Restore Britain was launched first as a movement in, I think, June of 2025, is because I think that Rupert Lowe and his team admired the fact that even though it wasn't in perhaps my professional interests to be so supportive of him as I was during that whole debacle, and in the same way that Charlie Downs was, in the same way that Lewis Brackpool was, in the same way that Connor Tomlinson was and others, because it wasn't advantageous for us to speak out, as indeed we did then, and alienate Reform as we did irreparably during those early months of 2025, we did so anyway, because we didn't think that this could be defended on principle. And so I like that Rupert is, contrary to more or less everyone else on the right, a principled man who, crucially, and this is the main reason why I believe Restore to be such a vital vehicle for the restoration of Britain, he, being Rupert, is not committed to playing politics obediently within the progressive framework that we've had served up to us and which has functioned as the sort of de facto over
the window. It's remarkably refreshing.
It's been incredibly refreshing. So, for instance, he has never said that, Britain isn't, immigrants are the lifeblood of this nation. He has never said, as Farage did, that mass deportations would be politically impossible. Rupert is on record saying that he is concerned about the demographic expansion of Islam across the British Isles. Farage, as we all know from that Winston Marshall interview, is more fearful of alienating the Muslim community than he is of standing up for the interests of a host population that has nowhere else to go if it becomes stateless. So on all of these sort of crucial points, these sort of pillars that underpin, in many ways, the very progressive framework that is smothering us as a nation and euthanizing us as a people, Rupert is willing to take all sorts of slings and arrows to dissent from that in a way. And whereas Farage tries to play a slightly more tactical and strategic game.
Well, there's a distinction I always get with those is that when I'm hearing Farage speak, what I'm hearing is a timescale that goes up to the next election.
Mm.
Or if he ever goes beyond that, if somebody pushes him to say, okay, well, what about 2050 when we're a minority in his own country? His mind goes to, and how do we win elections in 2030?
Yeah, right, yes.
Whereas when Lowe talks, you can hear he's quite clearly talking about the next 1,000 years of his country. It's a completely different perspective of what matters. So you're on the Restore team.
Mm-hmm.
What is it you do for them?
So day to day, I am the I lend assistance wherever it's needed from moment to moment, because we're a very small team, and sometimes we need to be somewhat dynamic in assigning jobs to people. But for the most part, overwhelmingly, what I do is I work and lead effectively the policy unit within Restore Britain, and we have put out a number of detailed policy papers. Our first one, our first massive one, which took quite a long time, which I wrote, was on sort of mass deportations, legitimacy, legality, and logistics. Good sort of 100 plus pages or so. That was published to much fanfare in, I suppose it must have been November of last year. Since then, we've done a paper on anarcho-tyranny, which I wrote. We did a paper on the restoration of the British pub, which I didn't write, but which I oversaw. We've done one on energy security, which I wrote, but given that I'm not technically an energy specialist, I wrote with the assistance of a lot of people behind the scenes, including critical people within the energy sector itself. I am responsible for all of our formal, let's say, policy output, whether it's writing it, thinking about it, or if it's an area in which I'm not technically that strong, just overseeing it and editing it and overseeing the peer review process. An editor and writer. But a lot of them I have written because I do have domain knowledge here and there, but not, of course, not everywhere.
And you talk about sort of sampling widely from the people that you reach out to for this, but obviously working with Rupert is a key aspect.
I meet with Rupert fairly regularly. At the moment, if people are interested in what we're working on at the moment, obviously at the moment all of our time, my time particularly, is taken up with the rape gang inquiry report, which this is an example of one that I have not written. It was written by the barrister who led the whole effort the week in which we were hearing testimony and all the rest of it, and has done the vast, 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 vast majority of the legwork on this, of course, aided crucially by the very brave survivors and witnesses themselves who agreed to speak to us. Many of them will, of course, have their names redacted in the final report, but I'm in the process of editing and threading that all together, just so it reads well, getting rid of duplication and all the rest.
So the grooming gangs one, I suppose, is perhaps a bit of a special case, but nevertheless, all of the policies that you're putting together, and you talked about deportations and energy and pubs and a whole bunch of other things that you're looking at. What is the sort of consistent thread? What is the golden vein that runs through all of the policy work in terms of what it is that Restore is trying to achieve?
The experience, I think this is felt very acutely by young people in particular, and so I will naturally bring that angle to it. But I think the experience of being a young, conservative-minded patriot today is that of feeling cheated out of an inheritance that was rightly yours, that should, in a fair world, have been handed down to you more or less intact, if not enlarged, but which we have been sort of like spitefully or due to cowardice on the part of our leaders, cheated out of. And so across a whole range of dimensions, it sounds a little bit trite in a way, but the major thread that runs through all of these reports is that we used to have not a perfect country, but a very good one that ran with, relative to other nations around the world, ran relative with a kind of relative Rolls-Royce-like purr. We had a very blessed demographic inheritance, for instance. We didn't need to depend too much on statute law. Statute law, as the classic Anglo-American conservative critique of statute law, that is to say laws passed rationalistically by Parliament, the major critique made of this by conservatives stretching from Fortescue to Roger Scruton, is that statute law, the kind that prevails on the continent, anticipates problems in advance, tries to construct general principles for dealing with them, and then those general principles stoop down in order to meet the particulars. The great virtue of common law, which is a completely different form of law, spearheaded and trialed by the English.
Which emerges from the judgment of juries.
It emerges from the judgment. It is sometimes called in the literature, sometimes called judge-made law, but it's, as Scruton argues, it's probably better described as judge-discovered law, because we're talking here about judges and juries working on the basis of moral intuitions that address the particulars, and then the general principles are then built out of the particulars. So with statute law, what you do is the general tries to enframe the particular, where, or the universal tries to enframe the particular, whereas the distinct virtue of common law is that it is it is out of particulars and out of genuine cases, practical yes. circumstances, that general principles grow, and then they can be applied to future cases insofar as they resemble the previous ones.
I mean, back in
so we had that whole body of common law,
yes.
which in the last 100 years, to get back to your point, it sounds a bit pompous in a way, but has been eroded by like consistent passages of statute law, which have in fact scrambled this whole very pleasant arrangement. So on everything from Britain's legal system to our ancient constitution to our blessed demographic inheritance, we are in favour of restoring the pre-revolutionary state of things.
Yes, getting back to, I mean, on that last point, I remember when I did my degree many years ago, this would have been about 1997, I did one module on law. The guy who was teaching the course, he said, well, of course, you know, the Italians, they have many laws and they tend not to obey them. Whereas in Britain, we have very few laws and we tend to obey them.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that is something you could say in 1997. You cannot say it 30 years later in 2026. And we now have many laws. And the British psyche is having to update with all that. Mm-hmm. It's like, well, if we're going to have all of these laws and they're covering absolutely everything, you know, why? What wasn't it for me? I mean, is driving a different agenda? So the party, what you're saying is the party is really aptly named. It is a question of a restoration of something that we had and was lost, and that is the consistent theme through all of your policy work.
Absolutely, on everything from law to demographics to the constitution. To state capacity, to sort of industrial capacity, on all of those fronts, we are interested in. We should be clear, not because we regard the past as a sort of an axiomatically good thing. Mm. There are all sorts of ways in which things are better now than they were in 1926 or 1826.
Can you give an example?
Well, the one that people will point to is the state of modern medicine, I suppose. We have made sort of technological advances.
Not very good for the funding model of the NHS, that.
No, that's true. But a hell of a lot more about that than I do, which is why I like the way that Peter Hitchens has tended to put these things. It's not so much that we look through the past through rose-tinted spectacles. It's more that we note the fact that given where we have been in the past, we have been consistently picking the wrong future. And so yes. I suppose we want Britain in 2026 or 2029 or 2034 or 2039 or whenever it is to resemble the Britain that we were on course to be, but for.
Yeah, well, I mean, I simply note that the British people have had the largest empire the world has ever known.
Yes.
The Anglos that went off to Canada had this big, open, bloody space. What are you going to do with this? And they turned it into a successful country. You know, we sent our lowest of the low.
Mm.
Are criminals to Australia.
Yes.
And they turned an enormous desert into a thriving first world country.
Yep.
New Zealand's doing all right. And the Americans, I mean, they've got something to their credit today in terms of a bit of an empire. So the Anglo people are enormously thriving. I mean, their track record on the global stage is unparalleled. So I know what we can do as a people.
Yep.
I also note that we are doing almost none of that today. We are moribund. There's no growth. There's no enthusiasm. I mean, the morale has collapsed. I mean, simple things like army recruitment. You know, young people. You ask them. You know, would you sign up to fight in our latest globalist war? I mean, every part of that is wrong because they don't agree with the strategic direction of the geopolitical aims of our elite class. And also, they ask the question, well, what would I be fighting for? You know, what you've given everything away for my country. So I completely get all of that, but what does restoration really start to look like? Because the reason I mentioned what the Anglo people can do is that was always done in an era where there was next to no restrictions on what they could do. I mean, the restrictions were, you know, don't kill anybody, don't cheat anybody.
Yeah,
it was the basic obvious stuff. It was the stuff that emerged from common law.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas what you talked about was the statute coming down.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, try to start. I mean, for example, my father, you know, I mentioned he's in the police in our podcast segment earlier. At some point, he quit that and he decided to open a business, and he just got on with it. And you can't do that in business today. You have string of regulations, you have a string of requirements, you have a string of training you must put your staff through, the weight of taxation. You can't just do things. So what does restoration look like? Is it stripping away stuff, or is it something else?
Not blindly and arbitrarily, no, but I'll give you an example. Before the 1965 Race Relations Act, which is an example of a pernicious statute, a malign bit of legislation, as far as I'm concerned. Obviously, it sounds like a perfectly... Who could be against nice race relations?
I can. You know, on principle.
Well, you know, this is what our opponents always do, though, isn't it, Dan? They'll craft a bill filled with all sorts of bilge, yes, and they'll call it the Protecting Fluffy Kittens.
The Rainbow and Sunshine
Act.
Yeah,
Protecting Fluffy Kittens Act.
Yes.
And then anyone who's against it wants to see fluffy kittens slaughtered. So this is how they operate. But what that did is it replaced something that in English common law is called the breach of the peace principle with more sort of overt sort of anti-discrimination legislation, which was later updated in the form of the 1986 Public Order Act, which saw Lucy Connolly sent to prison. Because the Americans were clever, they have this common law breach of the peace principle as well, which and I actually know how it's I can't remember exactly how it functions in English common law, the exact phrasing, but in America you are only guilty of incitement if you are inciting, this is Brandenburg, Ohio, 1969, imminent lawless action. So a very high threshold.
Go and shoot that man over there.
Exactly. Like a very high threshold used to be set prior to the 1965 Race Relations Act and then later the 1986 Public Order Act. Prior to those malign bits of legislation, the threshold for incitement was set incredibly high, and it still remains there in the American case because they had the good sense, and understandable given the way in which the behavior of the British Parliament from their point of view in the 1760s and 1770s dimmed the American view of parliamentary sovereignty. That's why they wanted a law-governed constitution, and they actually codified a lot of this stuff in their constitution, not least the First Amendment, which is why the common law breach of the peace principle still formally obtains in the United States in a way that it doesn't here, because it has been eroded technically by parliamentary sovereignty, because parliaments have been busily passing bad legislation such as the 1965 Race Relations Act and the 1986 Public Order Act. And a good example there would be, again, what they always do with these bits of legislation, there will be some good stuff in there, deliberately put in there in order to make it so that the bad stuff can survive alongside it. So targeted repeal of the sections and subsections that have been pernicious in those bits of legislation, whether the 65 Act or the 1986 Act, we're talking about that sort of thing. A targeted attempt to restore the previous order of things on these questions, which we think is very much in the interest of the British people.
If you enjoyed that content, and of course you did because you are a smart person, then why don't you go over to lotuseaters.com, where you can watch the whole episode for as little as £5 a month, which really is not much money at all, and you get loads of really good content.
Looking for excitement? Chumba Casino is here. Play anytime, play anywhere. Play on the train, play at the store, play at home, play when you're bored. Play today for your chance to win and get daily bonuses when you log in. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Chumba Casino is free to play.
Experience social gameplay like never before. Go to Chumba Casino right now to play hundreds of games, including online slots, bingo, Slingo, and more. Live the Chumba life at ChumbaCasino.com.
Plus, terms and conditions apply.
Want instant MVP status? Join the new Dick Scorecard Plus program. For $99, Scorecard Plus members enjoy 1 year packed with perks, like $80 in annual bonus rewards, free shipping with no minimum purchase, triple points on 2 purchases, and more. That's over $160 in benefits. Join Dick Scorecard Plus today and score more than ever. Tap the banner to learn more. Exclusions and terms apply. Visit dicks.com/scorecardplus for details.